Welcome to Film Forum's podcast. The following event was recorded on March 22nd, live at our theaters located at 209 West Houston Street in Manhattan.
Over a dozen film books and 13 film documentaries, and has been involved in restoration work with the Motion Picture Academy, the Mary Pickford Library, and Warner Brothers. And along with Kevin Brownlow and just a handful of others, Joe is one of the world's leading authorities on silent films, with a particular passion for some of the great female stars of the silent era, but it's his abiding more which brings him here tonight. That love was directly responsible for our being able to see tonight's long-thought-lost film, a saga that began right here at Film Forum 16 years ago, and here's Joe to tell you about it.
Thanks, Bruce. I hope you can hear me. Synthetic Sin is the charming tale of a starstruck young lady with very little acting ability. Determined to become an actress, the girl is convinced her lack of talent is due to her abundant innocence. So she's going to travel to New York City to sin and learn about life. This paper-thin plot of a dumb Dora was the perfect image of a typical Colleen Moore programmer, that of the nice girl who pretends to be more worldly wise than she actually is. For at this point, although she was typed as a flapper, Miss Moore was making relatively few flapper films, but would follow up this film with the ultimate depiction of the red-hot modern woman, the splendid YB Good that was shown here last night. Synthetic Sin was the first film of her final four-picture contract with First National, and she was at the top of her career. Every season of the year, she brought out another feature film, and each one was a hit. Thank you. This one was based on a Broadway play that played 24 performances at the 49th Street Theater, and then Tom Garrity created the continuity for the programmer. It was her second film to be directed by her good friend Bill Sider, and it cost $321,412.32, of which $125,000 was her salary. And within 6 months domestically, it earned $797,263.15 at a time when audiences were looking to attend the new talkies. Now, a few problems occurred during the production of Synthetic Sin. First, the studio requested that she use a relatively unknown actor as her leading man, James Ford. They had done this before. Donald Reed in Naughty But Nice, Larry Kent in Her Wild Oat. But poor James Flood, who was discovered in a Corinne Griffith film called The Outcast, was found to be unsuitable after 4 days and was replaced. He spent the rest of his life as an extra. Additional clashes occurred on stage number two when actress Billy Dove found it nearly impossible to emote and cry on her film, Adoration, while the Colleen Moore film, which was on the other side of the stage, was creating comedy mayhem. So her director, Frank Lloyd, was forced to shoot the Billy Dove film in the evening after the Synthetic Sin troupe went home. Also, Colleen had appropriated the leading man in the Billy Dove film, Antonio Moreno, as her replacement leading man, which meant he was forced to work two films 24 hours a day for 5 weeks. And if you see the surviving one reel of Adoration, he's exhausted. This led to a rift between the two ladies, and when Colleen left First National at the end of her contract, Miss Dove gleefully commandeered Colleen's bungalow dressing room, which now holds Clint Eastwood. He's currently the resider there. It's a five-room thing with a sunken bath. Not exactly what you call a dressing room. Although she was number one box office at First National, 1928 was a year in flux. There were numerous reshufflings of the studio hierarchy, and briefly Joe Kennedy was brought in to reorganize the corporation, as he had done at FBO, but when his proposed merger of First National with Pathé and FBO fell through, all of his unfulfilled promises and merciless firing of long-term contract players and executives led to his removal nearly on the heels of his arrival. Then on August 17th, the Stanley Corporation, which owned one-third of the First National stock, sold it to Warner Brothers, who were flush with their profits from the Vitaphone shorts and three talkies, thereby supplying them with a state-of-the-art studio facility, which they took over on October 2nd, 1928. Now, when Jack Warner came out to do a tour of First National, he discovered, much to his chagrin, that the average cost of most features was $250,000 to $300,000. That was nearly three times what the top Warner Brothers film was costing at the time. Yet Colleen's contract gave her complete control of nearly every aspect of her career. Choice of stories, director, cast, even the type size of her name appearing on the screen before Synthetic Sin, and all publicity. And if she didn't want to talk in films, she didn't have to. But if she did, they had to pay extra, $2,500. After the merger, the Warner Brothers let Colleen know in no subtle manner that she would not be treated any longer with kid gloves. If she remained popular, she could ask for anything. But the two ways that she could lose this control would be, one, if her voice didn't record well, and two, if she developed bad press relations. Her testing at Famous Players Lasky had proven that her voice did record well. So to blacken her reputation, Jerome Beatty of the publicity department, on behalf and orders of Jack Warner, wrote and circulated a damning letter and sent it out to the editors of all of the editors of the fan and trade magazines. The next day she discovered this, and she shot off a three-page inflammatory telegram to the bosses of First National Pictures, stating that Mr. Beatty's letter was antagonistic, irreverent, aimed to destroy her credibility and any future publicity for her productions. And since she always maintained good relations with the press, they had alerted her to the existence of the letter. But even so, this gambit might have worked, except the returns from Lilac Time, an earlier film, were coming in, and those millions of dollars spoke louder than the attempted smear campaign. So the next day came the notice of Mr. Beatty's dismissal, telegrams from Al Rocket, head of West Coast Productions, and her 26 bosses, quote, "The most important thing for us is to keep you happy and to give you the very best." This also came with an offer for a new contract at $15,000 a week. 1928, $15,000 a week. Of tonight's director, Colleen said, "Bill Sider was with me a long time. He made some of my best comedies. He was wonderful, inspired when it came to gags, because in those days, a script was a very loose thing, and business was developed directly on the set. He did it as we went along, and he added a great sense of timing to the comedy, which made any audience laugh." Now, the film tonight was originally available either with or without a Vitaphone musical track, but there was no dialogue. To date, the discs for The Last and the exit music are the only ones that exist, so you will have the opportunity to hear the film in both formats. But here are a few things to look for in the film. The outdoor mansion for the evening fete is known as the Shelby House. It was located at Universal Pictures and used for decades in many productions. And its rental was $750 for 4 days and three nights. And among the extras, if you are able to spot them, are two movie directors, Mervyn LeRoy in the evening entertainment, and Bill Sider as one of the many policemen at the climax of the film. My very special thanks to Ned Price of Warner Brothers for the restoration of this and other films, Ron Hutchinson of the Vitaphone Project, Steve Sterner for his excellent musicianship, and especially Bruce Goldstein, for screening this film, not once, but twice within a year. Thank you.
One thing, I made a mistake. The saga really was with Why Be Good began here, because Ron Hutchinson said that the film was lost, and Joe raised his hand. He said, no, it isn't. There's a print in Italy. That began 16 years ago with both these films,
right.
Why Be Good and Synthetic Sin. It all began here. This one is missing the soundtrack, the Vitaphone soundtrack. It's silent until the very last reel. So Steve Stirner is going to play up to that point, and at which point, last reel, the Vitaphone soundtrack, the original soundtrack, will kick in. So here is Steve Stirner at the piano. Thank you, Joe.
Here.
Thank you for listening to Film Forum's podcast. Visit us online at filmforum.org, where you can learn more about our films, memberships, subscribe to our free weekly e-newsletter, and to find out the ways you can support our nonprofit cinema. And if you have the time, please visit our iTunes page and leave a rating and review of our podcasts. Copyright to this program belongs to The Moving Image Incorporated.